continue to serve Him. And when we do that, we really are letting our light shine. And so for that, we can give God thanks. I want to talk in a couple lessons about the devices of Satan. We read in let me turn this on, and it would help. It would work better. There we go. It is a strange statement that every time I read this statement, it kind of causes a chill to go down my back. Jesus said this to Peter, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." We watch, and I'll put it in the context of a lot of stories that we watch in movie form or read, perhaps, of someone who is in a life and death struggle. There's a bad guy with a gun. There's a menacing tiger on the loose, bear on the loose. There's some kind of a problem. There's an earthquake fixing to happen. And our hope is that the bear won't turn and look directly at you or me. Or the guy with the gun comes in and you're the one he's looking for. Or the earth starts to open up and the crack is opening up right under you. We hope that we just won't be noticed by the bad guy. Well, in this particular case, the bad guy is Satan, the greatest of all bad guys. And I don't mean to trivialize it by using the trite expression bad guy. He is evil in every way, to the deepest depths and to the greatest extent. And now Satan has turned his attention on Peter. That's scary. Because certainly, in the movie, the reason it's so bad is that the bad guy turns to you and you've got no defense. You've got no gun, or the earth's going to open up and you can't fly. And the bear turns his attention to you and you can't outrun him. And so you recognize that this is your doom. So Satan turns to you and you realize that you don't have any defenses against him. I'm talking about you as an individual. Now, God gives us things that we can fight Satan with. But understand, without those devices, instruments, and principles that God gives us in His Word, Satan will defeat us, and has. I mean, we're often prone to say about a certain situation, "Don't worry about me, I can handle it." Your brother comes to you and says, "I'm worried about you. I know this is going on in your life. I want you to stay strong, and I'm willing to help and walk with you. We can walk together for a while. Don't worry. It's okay. I can handle this." As soon as I hear that statement, and as soon as I might be prone to think that statement, I ought to always remember 1 Corinthians 10:12. "Take heed lest you fall. Let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall." We have to acknowledge the fact that while I think I can hold up under the circumstance, I have to acknowledge Satan is greater than I am. Satan is one of the original angels that fell in a rebellion against God that we know very little about, except to know that we are created lower than the angels, and it would be an unfair fight. We will not, and while yes, I might defeat Satan on a particular occasion, on a particular temptation that he throws my way, but I should not have the idea that I am master of my emotions and my passions and my desires, because I've defeated Satan a few times. It isn't about a particular battle, it's about the war. And Satan will defeat us. And for, like I said, for most of us, most all of us, Satan already has. We have fallen prey to sin, and once we are stained with sin, it is like anything that stains us today cannot be washed off. You know, Pilate washed his hands and told the Jews, "I don't condemn him. You do something with him." And metaphorically, he was trying to say, "I'm not responsible for this." But what do we recognize? Well, he was responsible because he had the power to stop it, and he did not. But that washing his hands, even the metaphorical concept, is not sufficient to take sin or to wash away the stain of sin. So Satan has turned his full attention to Peter. Now, Peter's going to fall, Satan. Jesus acknowledges that when you've returned to me. Now, Jesus can foresee in Peter this great weakness that he will fall because of. But he's also can see in Peter something deeper than that. And that is that even though he falls, unlike Judas who went out and hanged himself, Peter is not going to give up. This is why God gave us Jesus Christ. Because he knew that while there are some of us who will give up, there are many of us who will not. And if God could provide us a way that we could remove sin, that there's hope, there's potential for us. Not because we'll live completely apart from sin by our own strength, but because that sin can be removed by the blood of Jesus. And he says, when you return to me, strengthen your brethren. I want to talk about the devices of Satan. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2, it talks about a man who had been marked and withdrawn from by the church at Corinth for living in sin, living with his father's wife. And he had come back and he had been forgiven. And he is encouraging in the second chapter of 2 Corinthians the Christians there to receive him and to reaffirm their love for him. And it says, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. One of the devices, we must never forget this, one of the devices, what he's talking about here, one of the devices of Satan that is perhaps the strongest is the perception that people have that we don't love them, that we don't care about them. And we've got to take every opportunity we can and even make some opportunities to reaffirm our love for others. Obviously, there are limitations to fellowship and things like that. We can't reaffirm by compromising the truth, but there are ways that we can affirm our love for people through telling them and showing them by serving them and helping them in various ways. And even though we may not be able to fellowship them, we can't fellowship all. We recognize that. We can affirm our love for them. But I want to talk about the devices of Satan. Now, in this lesson, I want to start out by talking about the consequences of Satan's devices. When we are overcome by these devices and we don't avail ourselves either of the strength that God gives us to overcome the temptation, or we don't avail ourselves of the opportunity to come back to God, then I want to talk about the consequences of the devices of Satan. Now, next week I want to talk about the devices themselves and how we can recognize them and avoid them. I want to talk about that because in that order because I want us to understand the gravity of what it means to give in to these devices. A lot of times we think that we're like super fish and we can recognize the bait that's on the hook every time. And we will be able to outwit the fisherman Satan when he tries to catch us. You know, I think in the fish world, they probably think that they're pretty smart too. But the reality is that people get caught all the time. Fish get caught, people get caught. So while I may feel that I have a pretty good grasp on Satan's devices and I can see them coming and I can outwit Satan, I need to understand that that's not sound reasoning because I know I have fallen prey and everybody around me has fallen prey. Now, if we have a problem with a life-threatening disease and it is everywhere in everybody, how seriously do we normally take that? Well, that's the number one thing that gets our attention because then we're talking about life and death. So we recognize that when it comes to Satan's devices, he insists on our ruin. And understand the fact, I started to preach a lesson on Satan first, but I'm not going to do that this time. We'll save that for another time. But suffice it to say, and we know the Bible teaches this, Satan has already lost the battle. Okay? Jesus in the grave, there was the Revelation 12 in figurative term tells us about this battle in the heavenly places, and Satan was defeated and cast out of heaven, and after that, salvation and the kingdom were established. So when Jesus was in the grave, there was some type of battle that took place. Satan was defeated, and it's over. He is now reserved in chains, limited in his power, not completely, but limited in his power in some ways until Christ returns. So while we recognize that Satan is limited to some degree, he still has these devices that are very powerful. We have to acknowledge them. And it may not undo God's plan, but it could undo me and my part, my place in God's plan. And so I have to take this very seriously and recognize the dangers that we're talking about. One of the reasons that Satan gets an advantage is because we give in to temptation and we sin. And when we do that, we give Satan an advantage over us. All of us remember David's great sin with Bathsheba. After this, Nathanael said to David in chapter 12 of 2 Samuel, "By this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme." Now, it's certainly one thing for the enemies of God to blaspheme him. That's a terrible sin, and people who are guilty of that will pay a terrible price. I recognize that. It's another thing altogether for me to give them a reason to say things that they say. It's still wrong for them to say it, but now I have done something, I've sinned, and I've given an occasion for the enemies of Christ to blaspheme. Now, my part in this is that I've given their blasphemy resonance. With those around, they'll say, "Well, just look at Jeff McCrary. Look at what he does." And they'll say, "Yeah, you're right. And that's because of me." And that's why it's such a terrible thing that sin can unravel and undo so much good influence in my life. And I say, just this one time, and I also say to myself, nobody will find out. This will have no permanent effect on my relationship to God, because I'll come back. This is just a little one. This is aberration, and I'm going to come back to God and be stronger than ever. We say these things. But then when we give in to sin, it's a great advantage that Satan gets as a result of that. When you think about Peter and the fact that Satan asked for Peter to sift him like wheat, Peter was ripe for this. Even though Peter was bold in his statements, and I believe Peter really meant them, he drew his sword in the Garden of Gethsemane ready to defend the Lord and cut off Malchus the high priest's servant's ear. I don't think he was aiming for his ear. He wanted to cut his head off. I don't know whether the sword was dull or he just missed or what the situation was. But Peter drew his sword and was ready to die. But Peter was right because of a number of things. And these are the kinds of sins that give rise to this advantage of Satan. He was guilty of pride. He was guilty of prejudice, because he expected the kingdom to come in a certain fashion, and the Messiah to be a certain kind of person that Jesus never intended to be. And he did it because of selfishness. On one occasion, it's almost humorous. It happened a number of times, but this one time there was an interesting twist to it. It says in Mark chapter 9, "Then he came to Capernaum," talking about Jesus and the disciples. "When he was in the house, he asked them, 'What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road?' But they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest." And that's kind of funny, because, you know, we've seen children do that. Their parents walk in and says, "What did you do?" Not a word is said. "What is that on your face?" Not a word is said. The disciples kept silent. Why? Why did they keep silent? Because they knew what they were doing was wrong. They knew he would condemn it, because he had over and over condemned it and demonstrated by putting on servants' clothes and washing their feet, by telling them over and over who would be greatest in the kingdom. This point had been hammered into the disciples. They just refused to listen. Remember the mother of James and John come and say, "Would you promise me that my sons could sit on your right and left in the kingdom?" This was something that's very common human problem. Pride, prejudice, selfishness. And it could come in any number of forms. But this is what made Peter vulnerable, wasn't it? This is what made Peter vulnerable. Because when all of his thoughts about how things ought to go and his place in the kingdom, what it would be. You know, if you told Peter in that boat when Jesus, or when he's cleaning his nets actually, and Jesus said, come and follow me, if you told him then, look, there's no physical kingdom, the Messiah's going to die on the cross, and he's going to be buried and then ascend to the heavens, and then you're going to be one of his apostles, yes, but it will be of a ragtag persecuted group that will be scattered all over the world that will have no notoriety or money or fame or fortune and no place of prominence. I'm not sure Peter would have come. Because that's how strong his prejudice was. And that's what made him vulnerable when it all fell apart. And he didn't know what to do. And he actually stood there when a little girl asked him, outside of the court when Jesus was being tried, are you one of his disciples? He actually said, no, I'm not. I don't know who he is. And he cursed and swore that he didn't even know Jesus. How could Peter do this? That's the kind of advantage Satan gets over us. And how weak we can be all the while we are making these great pronouncements about how dying for God and being strong, even if all men forsake you, I will never forsake you. That's how vulnerable we can be, even then. If anyone desires to be first, Jesus goes on to say, he should be last of all and servant of all. He took a little child and set him in the midst of them. And when he had taken him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one of these little children in my name receives me. And whoever receives me, not me, but him who sent me. There's a lot of things we could talk about in connection with this little child and the thing he said about this child. We need to be thinking about how we receive other people. Now, I understand that our relationship in Jesus as brethren is important. And there's a love that we have for brethren that is greater than the love we have from other men. But let me say that if my friends who are not Christians are getting the impression that I don't love them, then I'm not doing my job. They need to understand that I care about them. And while it may not mean compromising the truth or fellowshipping people in their sin or joining, certainly not joining in with them in their sin, but I need to figure out a way to demonstrate how much I love other people. And I think the Bible has a lot of answers. Jesus set the example over and over. He spent time associated with sinners, not in sin, and not in compromising the truth, but in ways that he found that he could. And there are ways that we can, too, associate with and show that we care about other people. And someone lives a different life, and I understand that I can't fellowship them or condone or approve of the decisions they make. That does not mean that I completely cut them out of my life. Even about a brother who's gone astray, 2 Thessalonians 2, he says, don't count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. That's not really what the lesson is about, but that's what this passage is about. We need to show people that we care. Figure out how to do that. There is a way, and God shows us over and over. Love this passage here in Colossians chapter 1. And you who once were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he is reconciled in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and blameless and above reproach in his sight. It's a wonderful message of forgiveness that God gives. And he goes on to say, if indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you've heard. A lot of things in there that are so important. Because first of all, you can be presented holy, blameless, and above reproach in his sight, but you have to continue in the faith. You have to be grounded and steadfast. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and don't move away from the hope of the gospel. But that's what happens so often. We see something shiny, something appealing, something that the people of the world take for granted. It's something they do on an almost daily basis. It helps them deal with the frustrations of life, and they enjoy it, and we begin thinking or trying to figure out ways. We know that the Bible condemns it, and it's something that is a danger, but we begin to try to figure out ways that we can move over there to it. You ever told your child, you know, okay, don't leave the backyard? And you see them out there in the back, they're all, and there's the creek or the ditch, and they're just right there at the edge, you're just looking at it. Well, you know, if you're a parent, that you know what's going to happen. It's just going to be a matter of time and a lack of observance or intervention on your part. They're going to be in a ditch. Or are they, they're sitting in the back seat on a long trip. All right, nobody touches anybody. And one of them starts walking his fingers across the seat toward the other. You ever told your child, okay, nobody touches anybody. And about 5 minutes later, one of them says, he's looking at me. Well, I didn't say anything about looking. I said, but what are they saying? They know that looking eventually leads to touching. Eventually leads to a fight or a fuss. And parents just want quiet. You see, kids sometimes understand the progression towards sin. We can't move away from God. We can't move towards sin. We can't go over there and look at it and try to figure out the good things about it. Let me just understand, do I really want to do this? We sometimes get the idea that counting the cost of serving Christ is looking at sin and saying, how do I want to live my life? Do I want to live my life in this fashion, or do I want to live my life in the godly fashion? That's not what counting the cost means. It is an insult to God when we even think for a moment that the satisfaction of our passions in sin, in a sinful life, would be preferred over the godly life God offers and that Jesus died to preserve and set up. It's an insult to God to think that. He's not saying count the cost to decide which is better. There's no doubt which is better. He's saying count the cost to make sure you're ready. So when you see something like that, that all the world is flocking to, don't go over there and look at it and try to decide, well, is that worth giving my soul up? Is that worth losing my soul in eternity? Am I going to get so much joy out of this? We need to understand that this is a device of Satan, so that you size up the options and figure out from your wisdom. You got to remember what Jeremiah said. It is not in man who walks to direct his step. Solomon said there's a way that seems right to a man. So what we need to do, if we understand something according to the teaching of the Bible is wrong, we need to look the other way. Gentlemen, you see a woman that's not dressed modestly, look the other way. Ladies, you let your mind drift to someone who would care about you and be compassionate and loving and tender better than your husband, think the other way. We need to acknowledge how dangerous Satan's devices are and not begin to move away from the hope of our calling toward that which is destruction. I know that some of us have the strength, perhaps, in some particular situation to do so, but it's a dangerous habit to be in. The Bible teaches also that when there's trouble between Christians, Satan gets an advantage. When we refuse to forgive, Satan gets an advantage. That's what's talked about here in 2 Corinthians 6. We read earlier about the devices of Satan. This is the story that we referred to earlier. They withdrew from him, and as a result of that, he came back. And it says the punishment which was inflicted by the majority, that's talking about the church discipline, was sufficient for such a man. So that on the contrary, you ought rather to forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one be swallowed up with too much sorrow. Well, there's a problem that some people have with this whole idea of forgiveness. You mean he's done this great sin, this terrible thing, brought reproach upon the church, and now he's just going to come back and confess his sin and ask for forgiveness, and then we're just supposed to forget about it. And that just infuriates some people. Some people just can't understand that. You know what God says? It says the punishment of his grief, of his regret for the sin, of the shame that he bears, and his willingness to come and lay that before the congregation and ask for the forgiveness in a public way of anybody that is aware of the sin that he's committed is sufficient. You know what? God told Peter on one occasion to rise, kill, and eat unclean animals. This was a vision, Acts chapter 10. And Peter says, "No, Lord, I've never eaten anything unclean." And you know what God said? He said, "Don't call what is clean, what I have made clean, unclean." Okay, in this particular case, we need to be very careful of calling something that God says is sufficient, yet insufficient. God says it's enough. People who bear their sins, especially are willing to do so humbly in a public manner to cleanse themselves and to set the record straight, that they know what they did was wrong and they don't acknowledge that conduct to anybody as good and wholesome, and want everybody to know that, they go through a regret, a shame, a feeling of guilt and regret that is sufficient. And if God will forgive them, pity those of us that won't. That is a device of Satan. It helps us feel superior, better than others, righteous in ourselves. These are dangerous doctrines of the devil. And we need to understand these wiles. He says, we need to, on the rather, to forgive and comfort him, lest perhaps such a one be swallowed up with too much sorrow. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love for him. For to this I also wrote that I might put you to the test whether you're obedient in all things. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. We should never refuse to forgive. Well, I certainly, again, don't say we should ever compromise the truth or condone sinful activity. But when someone turns from that sin, we need to receive them. You know, and remember how God forgives. There are sins and iniquities I will remember no more. Peter says in Acts chapter 3, your sins will be blotted out. And the very wording there suggests that it is removed as if it never happened. As if it never happened. And that's how we should forgive. As if it never happened. Yes, they come back and make it right in God's eyes. And as far as we're concerned, it never happened. That's very difficult. When the sin was against us, I recognize that. All of us go through that in some form or other. And God calls upon all of us to rise to his standard of forgiveness. If not, Satan gets an advantage over us. And through hatred and anger and bitterness and words that are hurtful, we cause further sin to take place. We need to recognize that when we refuse to settle our differences according to God's plan, Satan gets an advantage. God certainly has specified how we are to handle problems. If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained your brother. That's your goal in this. If he will not hear, take one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. I personally believe that these are witnesses of the sin. But if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let it be like a heathen and a tax collector. He goes on to say, and this is the person that sinned against you. Now here's someone that you've sinned against them. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar, go your way. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. This is God's plan. Offer your gift, I should say. So this is God's plan. So you have, in effect, the person that has been sinned against and the person who sinned against him coming to meet one another. In my mind's eye, I think this brother who gets up on Sunday morning and he's getting ready for worship and he realizes he's done wrong to his brother. He remembers this passage in Matthew chapter 5. And he says, before I go to worship, I need to make this right. Or maybe it's Saturday evening. And there's another brother who realizes that I've been sinned against. You know, Jeff sinned against me. And I need to go and talk to him because his soul's in jeopardy. This is about his soul. And so you have the both of them driving one Saturday evening, and they cross in the road, and they look back, and they stop, and on the side of the road, God's plan works out perfectly. It doesn't take a lot of words. It doesn't take a long, difficult explanation. It's important that we recognize that God's plan works if we're willing to work God's plan. But there's all kinds of substitutes that we give sometimes. Instead of forgiving, I'm going to ignore the fact that he sinned against me. That's not God's plan. He's lost in sin. I'm not doing him any favors by ignoring. I may be keeping him comfortable. I may be avoiding a very uncomfortable, confrontation because of sin. And it's difficult. And I guess it's safe to say in our day and time, it's more difficult than it has been in other cultures at other times. But we still have to face this. I can't ignore the sin. I can't decide that there's any other way to handle this. There's no substitute for this mode of reconciliation. And we need to recognize that if we do begin offering human substitutes, then we make ourselves vulnerable to Satan's devices. Because, the only way that we can completely forgive others is by God's plan, the way the Bible teaches, and we've got to say it. We've got to recognize it. It's got to be something that's expressed. And it continues in our receiving them in the future as well. When saints quarrel, Satan gets the advantage. In Proverbs chapter 6, passage that's bigger than the screen, so we'll read it out of our Bibles. Proverbs chapter 6, beginning in verse 12. Solomon says this: "A worthless person, a wicked man, is one who walks with a perverse mouth, who winks with his eyes, who signals with his feet, who points with his fingers, who with perversity in his heart continually devises evil, who spreads strife. Therefore, his calamity will come suddenly. Instantly, he will be broken, and there will be no healing. There are six things which the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers." Well, that's pretty powerful when God puts this idea of creating discord or quarreling between Christians with these other sins. Some of the greatest things that bring God's wrath. Someone who chooses to politic in a local congregation. I've known of men who would call business meetings and only invite certain ones. Or who would always be sure to shake certain hands, but almost never shake other hands. And just in the general way in which they receive, it's obvious that they hold some in higher regard than others. We need to make sure that other brethren know it doesn't matter about money, it doesn't matter about skin, it doesn't matter about gender, it doesn't matter about anything that is a part of our physical makeup, that we, if we're Christians, will receive one another equally to the best of our ability. They need to understand that. We need to practice that. And when we do have disagreements, as Paul told the brethren at 1 Corinthians chapter 6, if it's something that can't be resolved and it's something that's not a matter of sin, then be defrauded. Then lose what is a matter of contention between you. If this is something that will resolve the quarrel, because recognize it's not yours to begin with. I'm a steward of these things that are in my possession. Brethren, when it comes to property and valuables and things of this life, we'll sometimes fight. And sometimes it's not about the value of what they're fighting over. Sometimes it's about the disrespect. Someone just helped themselves to something that belongs to me. Well, it belongs to God. And I remember the statement, it's an amazing statement made about the Christians in Acts chapter 2. It said, none of them believed that their possessions was their own. Do you think about that for a minute? None of them believed that their possessions was their own. They freely shared them with all who needed. Okay? So all of you have food in my cupboard. All of you have a bed in my house. All of you have gas in my car. And we need to have that attitude. If there's a brother or sister who needs something, what a blessing it is for me to be able to provide that. And so we need to have the attitude and never quarrel about these things. When the home isn't what it should be, Satan gets an advantage. It's easy to see between the roles of husbands and wives, the difficulties. The wife is taught to manage the home. Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands. The word of God may be blasphemed. In 1 Corinthians 5, therefore I desire that the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the house, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully. For some have already turned aside after Satan. That doesn't mean that a woman can't work outside the home, though. Worthy woman of Proverbs 31 did just that. But she took care of her primary responsibilities in the home. And the husband is to provide for his own. It says in 1 Timothy chapter 5, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Now, sometimes the family budget gets tight and the difficulties are there, and sometimes a husband expects his wife to get out and help for maybe for a period of time or longer if necessary. In the same way, fellas, the wife is to manage the home. That means that there are times when you have to help out there, just as she's expected to help out with the budget sometimes. The point I'm making in this is that we respect the roles that God has given us, and we don't quarrel about that. And when we accept that and serve one another as God desires us to do, then there's harmony in the home. But when there's discord in the home and Satan gets an advantage, and we see what he's done to the home today. Parents were supposed to raise their children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, train them up. That's their job. But in this day and time, we're told parents can't tell the children much of anything. We're told the parents can't discipline their children much, any way that's considered negative. We need to recognize our need as parents and grandparents, whatever degree that falls upon us, to rear our children with appreciation for the Lord, and yes, including some of the negative aspects of serving God as well as some of the positive aspects. When that doesn't happen, Satan gets an advantage over our children or in our home. I don't want Satan in my home. I don't want him there any more than I want a bad guy, the physical robber, someone who comes for other reasons into my home. I want God in my home. And I want godliness and love to rule in our home. These are some consequences of when Satan gets an advantage over us. And I want to talk next week about the devices themselves and how we can recognize them. I hope we understand how important it is, how deadly, how devastating Satan's devices are. And we hope as we think about these things, that we intend to make changes in our life that are necessary in order for us to be holy and blameless before God, moving toward God. If you draw near to me, I will draw near to you, James teaches. God says through the book of James in chapter 4. So if you're interested in drawing near to God today, we want to sing a song to encourage you to make your life right. What's the song number again? 423. We can be assured, just as Satan was defeated when Jesus was in the grave, that God's stronger. In 1 John chapter 4, John says, greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. And though Satan holds sway over the world and over the people of the world, generally speaking, God is more powerful. God is greater. God is more eternal. Satan is reserved in chains, and his angels will be cast into hell fire one day. We need joining Satan's army is like joining the defeated army after the battle's over. We need to join the army of God, make our life holy and godly, knowing that God's strength will preserve us, that God's forgiveness will heal us, and that God's path is the only one to eternal salvation. If you're subject to the call of God in any way, we'd love for you to come while we stand and sing.